Well, I think, first of all, it's a phase. I think it's normal for you to go, oh my God, my life sucks and I suck. And that's kind of what you have to get through in the beginning. But then after a while, you make a distinction between blame and responsibility. The fact that this is not my fault does not mean that I'm not responsible. Because if I'm responsible, I have the power to change it. So blame is you point your finger at someone else and relinquish all your power. So if it's always someone else's fault, you can't fix it.
Thanks for pressing play. This episode of Legends and Losers is sponsored by NetSuite. For a free growth review for your business, check out netsuite.com/legends. On this episode, one of my favorite people in the world, the amazing, the incomparable, the uncomparable, Dushka Zapata. She's a communications and PR executive in Silicon Valley. She works at a red hot company called Zendesk, and she is one of the most influential writers in the world. We have a fun, engaging, and most unpredictable conversation, as always. She's got a brand new book coming out the first week of November called How to Build a Pillow Fort and Other Valuable Life Lessons. I love the titles of her book. We talk about do you really need a soulmate? The difference between blame and responsibility, and why having a healthy relationship with debauchery and excess is a good thing.
Hello, my legendary friends. This is Legends and Losers, the show for people who like to eavesdrop on killer dialogues, brilliant rants, and crazy diversions, straight up with a business twist. Hosted by Christopher Lockhead, former three-time CMO and co-author of Play Bigger, who has one of the most strategic minds in marketing, but could also hide his own Easter eggs. And now, strap yourselves in. It's time for Legends and Losers.
All right, all right, all right. Hey-ho, let's go. Hello, my legendary friends. Welcome to a fantastic episode of Legends and Losers. If you're a longtime listener, thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. And if you're brand new, this is a very different podcast. We aspire to have authentic dialogues about what it really takes to design a legendary business and a legendary life. And the experience we hope you have is an eavesdropping experience. This is not an interview. It's a conversation. And on every episode, we try to have a conversation with a seriously accomplished person about not just their accomplishments, but their failures, and try to get into something, a conversation worth sharing, a conversation that matters. On this episode of Legends and Losers, I just couldn't be more stoked about sharing it with you, because Dushka is an incredibly special person. Here she is, the amazing Dushka Zapata.
It's been a little over a year.
Wow, that went by fast. How did it get to be a year? It feels like you just told me you were taking this new corporate job.
Yeah, it's been over a year.
So what's it like to be back in the corporate saddle again?
It is. Well, first of all, I think that Zendesk is not really the corporate saddle per se. And I think that the reason why I don't think it is because it's growing so fast.
Yeah.
Everything is different all the time. Like, you get used to something or put something in place or think that you've got something, and literally two weeks later, it is completely different. So I think that that is both terrifying and fascinating.
What's terrifying about it?
I just think it's very difficult to get your footing in a company that's changing that fast, or in an environment that's changing that fast. And I think that there's always a sense that you are mildly incompetent.
Yeah, you always feel slightly out of control.
Yeah, exactly. Slightly off kilter.
Yeah, I was just looking. It looks like Zendesk has a $6 billion market cap right now.
Yeah, it's doing really, really well. And yeah, it's growing super quickly. I'm really, really... It's just been a really incredible experience. It's been... The word that I would pick is it's been thrilling. It's really thrilling to be here.
And how has it changed or influenced, or has it at all, your writing?
Yeah, I think everything that happens to me, including this conversation, influences my writing, because my life informs what I write. I write every single day, which means that the material for my writing is happening around me. So I would say every insight I get, or every fear I feel, or every time I feel off kilter and I realize how much it gives me to not feel safe and how important that is for me and for my life, it informs my writing. So I would say a lot.
Why is it important to not feel safe?
Because being in your comfort zone is gray.
Say more about that, Dushka.
I think that the best experiences that I've ever had have been when I'm off balance, when I'm like not sure what I'm doing or not really sure what's going to happen later or not really sure what the next step is going to be. I think that that's when life is at its most interesting. And I think that it's really exciting to trust that you've got it, even if you don't know what it is. And I think that when you're really comfortable, you get complacent and things get boring and things get routine and everything looks the same and every day looks like Wednesday. So I really dig change.
It's funny you say that. I'm reminded we had Professor Tina Selig on the podcast, and I forget exactly her words, so I'm sort of paraphrasing, but she sort of said crisis or chaos is sort of great for creativity.
Yeah, I think a few things are good for creativity. I think the first, if I were to rank them in order, I would say the first is time alone. I think we really underestimate the importance of doing nothing and just resting and like breathing and like lying in the grass and watching the clouds go by and telling yourself that you don't have anywhere to go. I think that we underestimate that. And I think that without that, it's impossible to be creative because creativity needs you to be idle to really happen. And I also think that if you have a routine and your life is the same, people ask me, how is it possible that you don't run out of things to write about? And I say, I will run out of things to write about the day that I run out of a life, right? And if you get up every morning and your day is different, then you have stories to tell. So I think those two things would be key to creativity. And I think I'm a writer, but I think that the same holds true if you paint or if you write music or if you, are involved in like complex mathematical proofs. I think that all of those are different types of creativity. And I think that to foster creativity. Creativity does not bloom in a calendar where you have back-to-back meetings, where you have to switch what you're thinking about every half hour.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting, in this world of smartphones and devices and perpetual distraction, there's a thing that used to happen in many of our lives that doesn't really happen anymore, and that's being bored.
Yeah. I actually disagree. I think that we can be bored and be distracted. I think that those two things they're not a dichotomy. I think that you can be really, really bored and perpetually distracted. And I think that that leads to a sense of anhedonia, which is an inability to feel pleasure because you are entertaining your brain with something that isn't real entertainment. You're just kind of feeling a distraction after distraction after distraction. And I think that that leads to burnout.
The way you can be bored and, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Dushka. Yeah. You can be bored and distracted at the same time?
Absolutely. Distraction is not the same as the opposite of boredom. I think that the opposite of boredom is more like joy. And boredom is a type of numbness. And I think that it's feeling bored and feeling numb is being bored is the beginning of an inability to feel any kind of pleasure. If you feel pleasure or joy, if you are like this is a beautiful view or this food is delicious or sex is awesome or any kind of a sensation is the opposite of being bored. And I think that to be bored, you need to shut down your senses in a way. And that is disconnected from yourself. And I think a distraction, being constantly distracted is a very good way of being bored. You know what it is? It is you're distracted all the time. And at the end of the day, you wonder why your life has no meaning. I think being distracted is so terrible for you. I mean, a little bit of a distraction might be fun, but this sense of being perpetually distracted is, I think, a killer of creativity, but also a killer of joy.
The way I experience, I think what you're describing, you tell me if this is the right way I should think about it is, you know, you'll have those moments where you've been on your computer for 15 or 20 minutes and you're just sort of bebopping around doing nothing, right?
Yeah.
You read an article here, you see something there, you follow a rabbit hole here, And I, you know, you look at your watch and you go, fuck, like 20 minutes just went by and nothing happened. And I didn't really find, it's not like I was reading something I was interested in. I just, you know, you find one thing and you bebop to another. And is that what you mean? Or what do you mean?
That is what I mean. I think that distraction is a very intimate word, because the truth is that only you know if you are sedating your brain with that bebopping, as you call it, or if you are really learning something new. So if I could be on the computer for 20 minutes and unlock the secrets of the universe, right? Or I could be on the computer 20 minutes and sort of like glaze my brain over with a sensation of like clicking from one thing to the other and not really getting anywhere. And no one can tell the difference but me. And that is the intimacy inherent in distraction. And I think that if you are searching for a way to kill time, which is incredibly ironic, or if you're searching for a way to sort of like numb yourself, distractions are plentiful. And I think that if you're looking for a way to find something or learn something or create something, it feels completely different. I think that the constant tension for humans is, or maybe that's just me, is the tension between I really want to be comfortable because that's what my system has learned how to do, because comfortable is comfortable. And there is a numbness in feeling always comfortable that I need to fight against so that I don't go on automatic. So there are mornings where I get up, and between the time that I get up and I get on the bus, I don't remember exactly the mechanics of like brushing my teeth and like washing my hair and like getting breakfast and getting coffee. And I get on the bus and I'm like, what just happened? Or I go through the motions at work and I feel that I'm on automatic. And if you change your routine, and if you put some thought and some presence and mindfulness into what you're doing, then you're not on automatic. You are the opposite of being on automatic is you are alive. You are awake. And I think that's a decision that you have to make. And I think that it comes out of that breaking of the routine and not doing the same thing over and over and being present and not going on automatic. But I think you have to resist your own impulse to make things easy, to make things the same, to make things comfortable. So making things uncomfortable is in effect a way of resisting your most basic instinct, which is I just want to be comfortable.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I find that a regular refrain in my brain these days is we have confused, or maybe I should say I have confused comfort and aliveness, right? We seem to live in a world that teaches us that as we become successful, what we're able to do is be comfortable. And look, there's a certain level of being comfortable that's awesome. And I'm like anybody. I like to, you know, sit down on the couch and crack open a cold one and maybe watch a movie or read something or just be comfortable or hang out and talk. But the reality is, it is rarely the things that make us comfortable that make us feel alive.
I agree. And I think feeling alive is the best thing. I think feeling comfortable and feeling alive are at odds with each other. And I think that if you get too comfortable, you start wondering what it's all for, because you start losing yourself. And I think that you start being more and more afraid. And I think that the more you bet on yourself and the more you trust that you'll be able to work it out, or, you know, not, the more you are alive. And just to go back to what began this conversation is, you know, in this job, I am not doing things every day that I know how to do. A lot of what I do is like, I don't know, I think I can give it a shot. And I think that that is incredibly scary. And I think it's also awesome. And I think it's interesting. And it teaches me that, you know, not all of the time, but most of the time I can actually figure it out. And I think that inherent to being uncomfortable is learning to trust yourself and having faith in yourself and realizing that really what you need is you and not anyone else. No one else is going to save you, which actually brings me to the answer that I wanted to read you today.
Awesome. Then let's go for it. Because I've been reading a lot of your stuff lately. I've been, you know, as you know, I'm sort of streaky with Cora in the last, just as we put Niche down to bed, I've been spending a little bit more time and I've just noticed some of the things you're on. So I'm very curious what you've brought to the table today.
Yeah. So the reason I brought this is because the last time we spoke, you told me that you wanted to talk a little bit about your new book and what it's about and why you wrote about me. And you told me that you wanted to talk a little bit about what I've done on Quora and why. And so I found an answer that I think represents what I stand for and what I mostly write about. And I think that everything that I write about is it's some version of this answer. And it's as all my answers, it's not very long, but I think it's at the core of what I believe in and what I profess to other people. So that's why I chose it.
Awesome. Let's go.
And the question is, because you know that Quora is a question and answer site, so I answer questions. And the question is, do I need a soulmate, and where can I find him? And this is my answer. The greatest lie ever told is that there's someone out there who can make you peaceful, happy, and whole. If you suffer from a sense of dissatisfaction or despair, if you feel disheartened or lonely, it must be because you haven't found the person you're looking for. This belief implants a permanent sense of restlessness. What if instead I said to you that you are already whole and that your secret sense of dissatisfaction and loneliness is inherent to the human condition? No one out there has the ability to bail you out but you. You can eventually pick someone to walk beside you, to share in your experience, to rave about your good days and rant about your shitty days. If instead, in looking for a fix, you run from one person to another, you will run forever, because the antidote to your emptiness does not exist in anyone outside of you. Stop running. Give up that insatiable, desperate search. Love yourself. Know yourself. Save yourself. There is no one else.
That's fantastic. I've always, I'm trying to think of the conditioning of little boys, but my mind goes to the conditioning of little girls and sort of there's this Prince Charming that's coming and this sort of bullshit. And then, look, and I don't mean to throw the movie under the bus. It's a fun movie. But the I think of it as the Jerry Maguire crowd, you know, this.
You complete me.
Yeah. And yeah. That I'm 50% and you're 50% and we come together to make this whole and you complete me and I complete you and all that is just an inherently bullshit way of looking at things, because it says to me as the individual that I'm not whole without some other thing or person.
Well, it does two things. One is it proposes that you're not whole, which is absurd because we were made whole, every one of us. But the other thing it does is it engenders relationships that are based on codependence. So instead of you expect another person to make you happy, you know, you expect another person to make you whole. And therefore, your relationship is doomed to be unhealthy from the beginning, because you are expecting that another person is going to get you what you can get for yourself. And that is, you know, you're being a baby, literally. A baby needs it, the baby's parents or, you know, responsible adults to keep it alive. And then as you grow, you don't need other people to keep you alive and happy and healthy and well. And you never detach from that sense of I need other people to help me, to decide for me, to make me whole. And you destine yourself to unhealthy relationships.
And so I agree with all of that. That's been my experience as well. And in addition to that, our relationship with others is the source of so much of the goodness in our life. I think about this a lot, that, you know, the worst punishment we give in our society to people is solitary confinement. And so I think about that and go, wow, human beings need relationships so much that our idea of a torturous punishment is being left alone in a room by ourselves.
Yeah, and I think that is the difference between being interdependent and being codependent. So one thing is to say, I need other people. And the other thing is to say, without you, I will die if you leave me. Those are two completely different things. You know, one is the recognition that we are social creatures and rely on others to be happy and healthy and, like, you know, create community. And the other is to say, I need you to make me happy. I think that the analogy that I would use would be swimming. So say that you take me surfing and I fall off my board. So I'm so incredibly terrified that I cling on to you to save myself. What do you think will happen to you if you are incredibly tired and you have someone like me clinging onto you for my own survival?
Like, yeah, I mean, there's a chance you'll drag me under as well.
That's right. So swimming together is going to make me feel happier and safer than if I'm swimming alone, but I still need to swim for myself. And that is the difference. The same thing happens when you go on camping. Like, you don't carry, like, I love you and I need you, but I carry my own pack. If you have to carry my stuff, that makes me not interdependent, like we're going camping together. It makes me dependent on you, and you literally cannot help anyone else but you.
Yeah.
And then the same holds true for addiction. If you have a significant other that is an alcoholic or, you know, in any way addicted to anything, you can't save that person. The person can only save themselves. So I think we confuse interdependence with codependency and with dependency. And I think that it, we just wonder why the other person, you know, why aren't you doing your job and making me happy? And it's like, I can't. I mean, even if I wanted to, I can't.
Yes. Right?
That's just a really important distinction.
I think many of us, certainly myself, this has been true, where you're, for whatever reason, you fall into this trap where you're trying to make somebody else happy, and you work on it. And in some cases, you work on it for years, and you can't make somebody else happy. And, you know, I know other people in my life have tried to make me some other way than I am, and you know, they've had very limited success.
It's also really presumptuous for me to say that I can make you happy. Like, you know, what gives me that kind of power? And I'll tell you something. I have worked really hard on myself to figure out what is going to make me happy. So the assumption that someone else can, like, know better than me what's going to make me happy, I think is kind of condescending. You know, it's like going out on a first date and having the guy order for you from the menu. It's like, you don't know what I like. Like, I mean, I appreciate it, but can you let me order for myself?
So that seems like a weird thing on a first date.
But I think it's very similar to, I can make this other person happy. You know what I mean? Like, it's very, very similar. So I think that if you want to take that to the extreme, like making someone happy and being unable to, like there's a tragedy in that, right? But there's a small tragedy. What if you want to, what if you say, you know, this guy is addicted to, you know, I'll say alcohol. And I think I can save him. You know, I think that many of us have this complex of like, I'm the hero and I can save this person. I will save you with my love. And that's a little bit even, I mean, that's a real tragedy because you think that the other person's life is in your hands. And at the end of the day, the person has to say, you know, my name is X and I'm an alcoholic in order for the healing and the if there's to be any recovery, that's how it starts with you owning your own shit. And the realization that your life is your own and that you can save you and you can make you happy and you're not here to save others or make others happy is incredibly empowering and incredibly freeing. You are not here to take care of other people. You are here to take care of yourself.
Yeah, that's right. And what I have found in relationships is a powerful relationship is two people who in general have their shit together. And what I mean by that is their relationship with themselves is complete.
Yes.
And even if there's things they don't like about themselves, or even if there's things, you know, most of us are working on things. We're trying to learn things or get fitter or healthier or learn more about, you know, Italy or whatever the fuck it is we're doing, right? Most of us, you know, human beings are always working on shit.
We're a work in progress, all of us.
And so if you're willing to accept – if you're complete with that you're a work in progress, right, then that's a very different place to come into a relationship as opposed to who I am is not complete. That is to say something is missing and you, this other person, whether it's a romantic interest or, you know, could be a business partner, could be a collaborator of some sort, a sports partner, whatever it is, right, some other person – quote unquote, completes me, it leads to a fucked up, disempowered paradigm in your head.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what else it leads to. It leads to the replication of what happens to one to you with one person happens to you with everyone. Like, I'll give you a classic example. Why does everyone I date cheat on me? Why? And you keep going with this fracture in yourself to one person after another person and after another person, and who you are shows up everywhere. So if you are not a moderately together person, everything that you do replicates and presents itself in every relationship because it's something that you haven't solved in yourself. And, you know, the question is not why does everyone cheat on me? The question is, why are you attracted to men who cheat on you? You know, why, this is something that you're doing to yourself. And until you don't own that, whatever it is that you're not owning or taking responsibility for will happen to you again and again and again until you resolve it.
Yeah, the thing I love about that, and I remember when I first heard this, it was a real eye-opener That is to say, whenever anything quote unquote bad happens or good happens, or whenever anything in your life happens, there's one absolute constant, which is you're there.
That's right. The common denominator is you.
How do you think about taking responsibility for that, but at the same time not beating yourself up? So if I'm somebody who continuously finds myself in relationships where the other person cheats on me, how do I, on one hand, own that that's what's going on and that it's up to me to take responsibility and therefore do what I need to do to move beyond that, if I could put it that way, but at the same time not beat myself up and make myself wrong and, you know, the nobody loves me, everybody hates me, I'm going to eat some worms kind of mindset?
Yeah, well, I think first of all, it's a phase. I think it's normal for you to go, oh my God, my life sucks and I suck. And that's kind of what you have to get through in the beginning. But then after a while, you make a distinction between blame and responsibility. The fact that this is not my fault does not mean that I'm not responsible. Because if I'm responsible, I have the power to change it. So blame is you point your finger at someone else and relinquish all your power. So if it's always someone else's fault, you can't fix it. So to me, it's about saying, how can I see this so that I'm responsible so that I can fix this? Not because it's my fault, but because I want the power back.
Yeah, that's an incredibly powerful thing. And, you know, I was just talking to my buddy, Hal Elrod, and this is a guy who has had some pretty unfortunate things happen to him. You know, as a young man, gets hit by a drunk driver and actually dies, gets brought back to life. And then the recession hits and wipes him out as his sort of second career is taking off, and he's got to overcome that. And then he overcomes that. He becomes this famous writer. He wrote The Miracle Morning and all that good stuff. And then he gets hit with cancer. and you know, he talks about like how much adversity, like what, Lord, how much adversity do I have to, like, why do you have to keep teaching me this, yeah, right? But it's this weird thing when you say, I'm going to choose cancer.
Yeah.
In the context of, I'm going to own my cancer as opposed to be a victim of it.
Yes, exactly. And I think being a victim is incredibly disempowering. I think it's terrible. And this is not to say that there aren't legitimate victims out there, but if you change your perspective, you put yourself in a place where you have a little bit more power.
Yeah. Now, I've been reading a bunch of your stuff lately, and there was something you wrote pretty recently. The question was, are you currently with someone you met online?
Yeah.
And you shared how you met your boyfriend, who of course you call boyfriend, on OkCupid. And in your answer, you said something that kind of stopped me dead in my tracks, Dushka. You said that one of the things on his profile that you liked was that he said that he had a healthy relationship with debauchery and excess.
Yes.
So tell me about A, why that statement attracted you, and B, you guys have been together for quite some time now. I want to unpack with you this sort of healthy relationship with debauchery and excess.
Yeah. So first of all, that's his line, not my line.
I understand.
His profile. I don't want to take credit for it. So he said in his profile, I have a healthy relationship with debauchery and excess. And I thought that was really fascinating. And the reason I thought that's fascinating is because I'm a person of extremes. I'm all in or not. So for me to, like if there's cake and it's delicious, I will eat the cake. If there's a gigantic bag of chips and it's like they're crunchy and salty and delicious, I will eat the bag of chips. So I don't understand people who like have a piece of chocolate and like eat just a little square and then leave the rest of the chocolate for later. I wish I could do that, but it's just not in my personality. So I'm very aware that it's easier for me to say no to something than to say I will have just a little bit. Having just a little bit doesn't work for me. In order for me to take care of myself, I need to say either yes or no. I can't say, let me just do that in moderation. Boyfriend is the opposite.
So you can't, sorry to interrupt you, but you can't have just a small piece of chocolate and be
done? I can't. No. I will finish the chocolate. I will eat chocolate past the point of comfort. I'll be like, I don't want the chocolate, and I will keep eating it until it's gone. So if I buy a really big tablet of chocolate, it is a catastrophe. I cannot leave it for later. Boyfriend, on the other hand, genuinely has a healthy relationship with debauchery and excess. He really knows how to drink. Like he likes to drink, and he drinks frequently, but he takes breaks. And I've never seen him, with maybe like one possible exception in 7 years, I've never seen him like not have control over the fact, like he gets tipsy and then he like brings it back. He can absolutely have like half a cookie and then leave the other half. So he has a very good handle on his, you know, the poisons that he picks, and he has a very good handle on his vices, and he parties and drinks and eats unhealthy food and, you know, has this life where moderation seems to work for him. I just find that super interesting. We're very different.
Yeah, I'm definitely much more like him. And then there's another dimension I'm curious about that may or may not be present, which is other people, the world, society can make you feel bad about drinking too much or, you know, being debaucherous. And so the other thing for me is like owning my debauchery. Like I love that. Yeah. And like there are going to be nights where I'm going to have 3 or 4 scotches.
Yeah.
You know,
he's like you. He completely owns all of the things. Like I'll be like, he's like, I'm going to go out with friends. And I'm like, are you going to drink? And he goes heavily. Like he's heavily. Not apologetic for, yeah, I'm going to drink heavily. And I'm like, okay, you do that. He's not apologetic about what he does. And he takes really good care of himself. Just in general, he's in every sense of the word, he's a really healthy guy, but he's deeply into moderation. I could not walk the lines that he walks.
Yeah. And is he like me in that, I can get absolutely shit faced and I can have a glass of wine with dinner and be done?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what he does.
Yeah.
He'll have, his drink of choice is Manhattan. He drinks Manhattans and he'll have a Manhattan. And then he'll like look at me and go, I wonder if I should have another Manhattan. No, I need to go to work tomorrow. Like he never exceeds what would be appropriate for that moment.
Yeah.
So he really does have, true to his profile, he really did have a healthy relationship with debauchery and excess. But that line really, really intrigued me. It was one of the reasons why I called him up to meet with him in person.
And I'm curious, does he have what I've sort of gotten better at owning over the years, which is, and I don't give a fuck what anybody thinks about it. So if somebody else thinks I drink too much too often or smoke too much pot or swear too much or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
I actually don't really give a shit anymore.
Yeah, I don't think he has ever worried himself too much about what others think, but I also think that he looks at it. Like he'll say, it's almost like if he finds value in like who is saying it or why they're saying it, he might take a look at it. He's a very self-examining guy. So he's very self-aware. So I would say that he doesn't care what others think of him, but if he saw a pattern in what others think of him, he would probably look at it.
Yeah.
He also doesn't like it when someone is like up in his business. So like, I would never say, you know, don't do that. Like, don't ride a motorcycle. People are like, how can you let him ride a motorcycle? And I'm like, let him? Like, what am I, his owner? So he has the audacity to do pretty much whatever he wants.
Yeah. Yeah. It takes courage to let that off the chain, but at the same time be somebody who's responsible. I'm sure he's not a careless motorcycle driver.
No, I think he's really responsible. And I mean, he has like a lot of like extremely technical of like motorcycle gear. He's like, this is the difference between, you know, scraping my entire thigh on the pavement and, you know, ruining a pair of pants. So he wears like appropriate equipment and the right helmet and like drives really carefully and, you know, all of these things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good for him. I mean, I've only met him a couple times, but all the more reason that I like him.
He's a solid character and he drinks scotch and Manhattans.
Yeah. I love Manhattans. I can't, do you want to hear a story about this?
Yeah, please.
I can't really drink Manhattans anymore.
How come?
The night we completed my first book, Play Bigger, I happened to be with my co-authors, Dave and Al. At least two of the three co-authors, and we were on a business trip. And the next morning, I was giving a keynote opening speech at a company's kickoff. And so we started celebrating drinking Manhattans. Anyway, we drank a shit ton of Manhattans, and I was about as hammered as I've been in my adult life.
Oh, that sounds horrible.
Was ridiculously hammered. And like hammered to the point of it's hard to find your hotel room. Once you're in the hotel room, it's hard to figure out where the toilet is. Like,
yeah, like absolutely drunk. See, I've never seen Andrew that drunk.
That's a very, very, I mean, that's probably the drunkest I've been in the better part of a decade. But anyway, long story longer. So go to sleep, you know, and I'm like the 8:30 speaker or whatever.
Oh my God, no.
Yeah, no, it's right. I woke up the next morning, Dushka, and I was still fucking hammered.
That is horrible.
And I thought, you know, I'm somebody who likes to eat breakfast. And so I thought, you know, I'll just eat some breakfast. I'll stabilize the patient and, you know, that'll make things better. Well, no, I'm fucking completely hammered. And so I'm sitting there in the back of the room and the beginning of this event is starting. And I'm beginning to have, you know, I always have a little bit of a conversation with myself before I speak, but I have to have a very serious conversation.
Pull yourself together, Christopher.
Yeah, because I am like still full on fucking drunk. Like, and I don't, you know, I like to joke and say any job worth doing is worth doing drunk. But the reality is I don't give speeches drunk. You know, that's not who I am, right? Anyway, so in this case, I'm going to have to do this speech, you know, eight or 9 hours later, still fucking drunk as a skunk. Like I wouldn't have driven a car. That's how drunk I was.
That is horrible. And the problem is that I think you know this, but I barely drink, like at all. And I'll have like maybe a glass of like Prosecco with a celebration or something, but I don't drink at all. Boyfriend went and found himself a woman who barely drinks. And, whenever I have been tipsy, which has been maybe twice in my life, it feels claustrophobic to me that I can't undrink. You can't step that back. Like once you're drunk, there's very little you can do. If you know, I have friends that I see, you know, throwing up because they have had too much to drink, and I'm like, I don't know what to do for you. Like you literally have to play this out. It's really horrible. It feels horrible. I don't know why alcohol is so popular. It has never felt good to me.
Well, I could spend hours explaining to you why alcohol is popular. You know, I'll just refer to that famous Ben Franklin quote, and God only knows if he actually said it, but beer is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy.
I don't know if he said it, but it's a good quote.
It's a good quote. But anyway, to finish the story, so I gave the speech, and, you know, at the risk of sounding immodest, I'm not a bad speaker. And I like to challenge myself because I've given a lot of speeches. And so this was a no shit challenge. And so I had to say, hey, Lockhead, like these people are counting on you. You got to go up there and you got to figure out how to do this. And you know, I ended up getting a standing O, which was great. So I pulled it off in the end, but I got off stage and I was still fucking drunk as shit. I was
terrible. I'm so sorry. That it does not sound like a fun experience for sure.
No, it's not something I want to do again. You know, listen, I'll have a, you know, a shot of scotch before I go on or something like that. Not always, but you know, on a fairly regular basis, but speaking drunk is not something I normally do.
Knowing when to stop. And you know, let's just like not talk about alcohol or drugs, which I, as you know, like I've just never been really particularly interested in any drugs, but let's talk about other things like, you know, cake or writing or, I mean, if I start writing, and which is something I love to do and I can't get enough of, boyfriend will come to the computer and say, you've been sitting here for 8 hours. Like, can we just go outside and do something else? Like, I have a compulsive personality. So I think I'm just really lucky that I'm not really into anything that could turn into an addiction, because I don't understand the notion of like doing just a little bit of something.
So you can actually write for 8 hours.
Oh my God. I can write for a lot longer than that.
Wow.
Yeah.
And when boyfriend comes to you and says, hey, love, why don't we not do that and go for a walk or whatever he might say, do you feel like he's interrupting your flow, or do you feel like, oh, it's good because you kind of need a break, or what's your reaction to?
I think that's a really important question, because I think that that's a question that people who write or who create something are up against when they are with people who don't do that. So, if I feel like I have something to write or I'm in the middle of something and he says, let's go outside, my reaction is, you understand nothing. Like, you don't understand. Step away. It's incredibly intrusive. But sometimes I'm tired and I've been writing for many hours and it's just like I've been in the same sitting position and I need to get outside and it feels a little bit like I'm being rescued. Like he's like, I'm glad I have him there, but it really depends. And if I'm in the middle of a thought that I think is just like worth articulating and I'm really close to articulating it and I'm interrupted and I lose it, like I lose the thought forever, it feels horrible.
Yeah. And my wife is really good with me about that. If she goes to interrupt me and I kind of wave at her, no, like I don't, if I'm in that place that you're describing, I don't even want to talk because I don't, I want to stay where I am. And if I just wave no, she's a saint. She just disappears and checks in with me at some point later. Or normally I check in with her because I know she's asking.
Ask her if she wants to come live with me.
The other place I find this, do you ever notice it yourself? Where this happens to me most regularly is surfing. I'm somebody who, comes out and, I generally will catch a bunch of waves fairly early in the session and I'll have, the first 45 minutes I'll be pretty active. And then I'll get to a point maybe 2 hours in, sometimes 3 hours in, depending on how good the surf is. But, maybe it's at the 2.5 hour mark and I'll have this aha that goes like this. I haven't caught a wave for like 20 minutes. I might be done. And sort of there's this place where you realize like I'm probably done. Do you ever get there or will you just keep writing until, boyfriend or some other thing pulls you away?
I think it depends on the day. But when I was not working and I could just write whenever I wanted, I wrote 10, 12 hours a day. With breaks, like I would go, write and then go to yoga and then have lunch and then whatever, but all in, I would write like 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
And I feel like the more I do it and the more it becomes a discipline, the less I struggle with what to write about.
Say more about that.
Yeah. So if I come to my computer and I go, I don't know what to write about. And then I start thinking, oh, I just had this conversation with Christopher and he said this, so I should write about this. And then sort of like, just like when you surf online, you described it as going down a rabbit hole. You find something that links to something that links to something.
Yeah.
The me writing is a little bit like that. Like I write about one thing and then, oh, it reminds me of something else. And then it reminds me of something else. So I start finding more things to write about. If instead I don't write and I don't get into the discipline of writing, I come to my computer and I don't know what to write about. But the last time that happened was a very long time ago.
So this thing people call writer's block is not something you
I am not familiar with that concept.
Yeah. You have the opposite, right? You have like writer's flow or I don't know what to call it.
It's true. One of my very favorite quotes from Prince, like maybe one of my favorite quotes of all time, because I felt it resonate in my chest so hard. He was in an interview and, the person interviewing him was saying, you write so much music and you're so prolific and you write about this and about that. And, it's like different kinds of music and you write, different rhythms and different styles. And he sat back and he said, it's like a curse to know that I can always write something new.
Yeah. I've heard that. And, in some ways I relate to that. I don't have that necessarily with writing. But people do ask me like, wow, you quote unquote put out a lot of content. How do you do that? And the funny thing for me, I'd be curious if it's the same for you. I know people don't mean it this way, but I almost take offense to the term, like you put out a lot of content. Like it doesn't feel that way, with Legends and Losers, it's like, well, I get to have these amazing conversations with people I'm dying to have conversations with. That's not some chore. And, I haven't written anywhere near the volume that you have, but the writing that I have done and do is, for the most part, of course, it's not always true, but it's true way more than not true. It's a labor of love. And so I don't have that experience with it. It's like there's an old, speaking of rock star quotes, Peter Wolf, who was the leader of lead singer of the Jay Giles band, he has this great quote where he says, people sometimes ask me why I scream and I shout. I say it's in there and it's got to come out.
Yeah. This is you're touching upon something that I think about a lot. So my mother is incredibly prolific. She's a sculptor and a writer, and she's written dozens of books and made hundreds of sculptures, and she's quite successful. She's really well known in Mexico where she lives. And she has a huge personality. And all my life I heard people tell her, you are so prolific. And there was something in the tone of the word prolific that I grew up thinking that it was not a compliment. And when someone tells me that I'm prolific, I actually have to separate the meaning that I have subscribed to the word and what it actually means, because my first reaction is to feel insulted. And I feel like it's a way for people to say that I'm too much. You know, you're too much. Like, and the way that I reconcile that in my head is, I think we, for all we know, we might be lost souls swimming in a fishbowl. For all we know, we might be here for absolutely no reason. But what I create, what I write, what I think, what I assemble, what I say, makes me feel like my life has meaning. And it's just very, like, I feel like I'm doing something really, really important. When I'm writing, I feel like I'm under the illusion, and I say this with no ego, it's not about me being amazing. It's about the work that I'm doing is reaching out to someone out there who needs to hear it. And I feel like I'm under the impression that my writing and what I post on Quora and like submit and throw out into the wind is having an impact on someone. And it's really, really important. And sometimes when I look at it, I think this could have been done better. But sometimes when I look at it, I think that what I just wrote is beautiful. And the fact that I'm sitting here feeling like my life has meaning and that I'm creating something beautiful, I cannot think of anything more important than that. And therefore, the fact that someone considers me too much is something that I discard. Because weighed against the fact that I'm doing something important, me being too much doesn't matter.
Hmm. Did you have this growing up? Because I certainly did.
Of course.
Like Christopher's too much.
Yes.
Like too loud, too... Yeah, whatever the thing is, swears yeah. too much, too hyperactive, so can't sit intense. Still.
Yeah, you're in
whatever it is.
So intense.
Yeah,
and it's like I just don't like I'm not saying that I'm not intense, and I'm not saying that I'm not too much. I'm just saying that I don't know why it would make sense to me to make myself less. I don't know why that would be something that I would pursue. I'm not going to make myself less so that other people don't find me too much. Yeah. I'm going to create everything I can.
Yes.
Until the day that I sit at my computer and I have nothing left to say.
And do you sort of have this feeling, because this is how I have it, which is sort of, if you think I'm writing too much on Quora by way of example, then stop fucking reading me or stop reading me for take a break for a while or, you know, do whatever you want. But this stuff's in me and it's going to come out and I'm going to do... You know, how many posts do you typically do in a day if you thought about averaging it out?
If I were to average, it varies a lot, but if I thought about averaging it out, it would be about 4 a day, which is not very much. But I mean, I write more than what you see on Quora.
Yeah. But I, you know, Quora is the primary place where I consume you. And there's no way I could consume everything you write.
Yeah.
And yet, you know... I don't know what – I've never thought about this. I don't know what percentage of what you put out I consume, but I don't think about it in the context of how much you're producing. I look at the stuff you're writing, and I read what catches my eye for whatever reason, and I'm just glad that you wrote it.
Yeah, and I feel when I'm writing it that I'm plugged in and that I'm a part of something important, and I don't – I mean, saying that I don't care if others read it or not is just, it's not true. I definitely want to be read, but it's not why I do it. I do it because it brings me pleasure and because I like feeling that I'm a part of something important. So I do it for myself.
Well, and you were not read, at least at anywhere near the scale that you have been over the last few years, for a very long time.
I had a blog that I consistently wrote in that nobody read, and I wrote in it regularly. Despite the fact no one read it, because I write because I want to, because I love it, not because it's being read, even though being read is awesome.
Yeah, and that's an interesting paradigm because, like, I know in the podcast world, there are a lot of podcasters who their mindset, their headset is, I am the audience advocate. And this is like, for example, this is my friend Jordan Harbinger. He's one of the most successful podcasters in the world, and I love his show. And his mindset, he said it on Legends and Losers, is he, if he's in a conversation with somebody, and he might even be interested in kind of where they are in the conversation, but if he feels like for whatever reason the audience maybe has had enough or whatever the case may be, that from an audience perspective, the conversation should go in a different direction than it's going, he will, in his mind, he's an audience advocate. And that's sort of his headset, and he's incredibly successful, and he's incredibly awesome, at least in my opinion, to listen to. However, that said, I'm the exact opposite. I ignore the fact that there's any kind of an audience. I just want to have a conversation with Dushka, and if the audience – look, I want the audience to appreciate it and love it. Of course I do, but in the moment, I'm not thinking about that. I'm thinking about, in this case, having a conversation with you. And if the audience likes it, great. And if they don't, well, you know, hey, sorry.
Well, let me tell you, I've never actually done this just because it's not interesting enough for me to put the time into it. But if I told you, if I gave you an actual snapshot, like if I took screenshots of the comments that I get on Quora, they would go something like this. Dushka, this answer is incredible. This answer sucks. You suck. You are amazing. I think this is too short. I think this is too long. I think that the use of this word is wrong. I can't believe you chose this word. It's perfect. So if I were chasing what the audience suggests that I do, I would be paralyzed. I would have no idea what to do. So I think it's important that I do what I want, because otherwise I would lose my way completely. So I think different things work for different people.
Yeah.
But I am not an audience advocate. I am here to tell you something. Basically, something happens to me, an insight. I'll give you an example. Holy shit. Other people are not supposed to make me happy. I'm supposed to do that for myself. Oh my God. I should write about this because people believe in soulmates and that other people make them happy. I wish someone had told me. So my drive behind writing is, I wish someone had told me this. Now that I figured it out, I'm going to write about it. And yeah. So I write about it. And it's less about writing something that I want, that it's less about writing something that I want people to like, and more about writing something that I found useful that I'm hoping other people find useful.
Yes. That's my headset as well. And it's the exact opposite of somebody like Jordan.
Yeah. But I don't think Jordan is wrong. I just think we each do what works for us. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I agree, because I love Jordan's show. I think he's a great guy. I've enjoyed very much getting to know him. And yet he and I have a 180 degree difference in how we approach this thing. So
I think that the three of us should do a show together and talk about this, because not to convince each other or anything, but just like to present different viewpoint, because, you know, the notion that whatever I learn, I want to share with others so that they find it helpful, about, you know, soulmates and like expecting someone coming in and on a white horse, like you said, and, you know, how some people can handle eating a whole bar of chocolate and other people can't do that, and et cetera, et cetera. I think it's interesting to people to hear how there are different things that work for different people.
Yeah, I would love to have that conversation, the three of us.
We should do that. Just by the way, I'm sitting in a conference room that I'm going to lose in about 5 minutes.
Okay, well then I have one other big thing I really wanted to touch on.
Yeah.
Now that you're sort of back in the corporate world, in your writing work, you have spilled yourself out in a very open and might even say, maybe you'd think about it differently, but in a somewhat vulnerable way. Like anybody who reads your work, you're not writing fiction. You're sharing your life in a very profound way. And so I guess my question in that regard is, as somebody who's so open and so, if I could use the word, vulnerable, but now you're back in the corporate world, how do those things fit in your brain?
Yeah, so I'm very open about everything that has to do with me, and very, very private about anything that is not mine to tell. So if you and I have a if you go, hey, I want to talk to you, I'm going through some trouble or whatever, and you tell me something and I'm like, holy shit, this would make an amazing story. What I tell myself is, that's not your story to tell. So if I was ever to write about that conversation, I would ask for your permission. And even if granted permission, I would never use your name. So similarly, if there's something that happens in my company that, forget about non-disclosure agreements, just something that I think this happened in a conference room and it would not be appropriate for me to share it, I never share it.
Yeah.
So basically, to summarize, I share it if it belongs to me.
And how do you think about the fact that you can walk into a meeting with somebody that you're meeting for the first time and they might have consumed, you know, dozens or hundreds of your posts, or they might have read a few of your books and they sort of have a real sense of who you are and you're just meeting them for the first time and it's a quote unquote professional environment and the context you write in is a much more personal environment?
Yeah, I would say I did this to myself. But also, I don't know. I feel like in terms of like just my personality, even in the most serious of corporate environments, I've never been different things to different people. Like, this is who I am. And, you know, you started, our relationship began by you being my client. And I was never like, oh, you know, I'm going to meet with Christopher and now I need to be someone else. So I feel like people pretty much see me regardless of whether they read me or not.
Yeah, very powerful. All right, anything else before we kick out of this one, Dushka?
I love you. Thank you for talking to me.
Dushka, I love you from the bottom of my heart. I'm so stoked that you were the first Legends and Losers guest. I'm stoked that you come back. And thank you, and I love you.
I love you too. Take care. It was amazing to talk to you.
I feel the same. Goodbye, my love.
Bye.
Whew. I can't believe that I get to have these conversations, and I can't believe that I get to share them with you. If you love this episode as much as I do, please share it with somebody in your life who you think would love Dushka. And make no mistake, your shares on social media make a giant difference. So please share Legends and Losers. Now, I know you're super busy. You're running around the world trying to build a legendary business. And one of the worst feelings in business is not knowing what's going on. Imagine you could look at your smartphone right now and you could get past the cat videos and other crapola on your social feeds and whatever your friends are seeing you, and you could see everything that's going on about your business, the stuff that really matters, accurate revenue and expense forecasts and updates during the quarter, accurate to the minute status of your orders, accurate data about how much cash you have on hand, what's going on with your inventory, or any key metric that matters to you instantly on your phone. That's what you get with NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the cloud-based business management platform that gives you real-time visibility into every component, every aspect of your business. They are number one in cloud ERP. They are the category king. They are the one source of truth for all of the key things in your business, including HR. And NetSuite is surprisingly easy to use and startlingly, you like that? Startlingly cost-effective. And that's why NetSuite is used by many, over 40,000 of the fastest growing entrepreneurial businesses on planet Earth. Right now, NetSuite is offering listeners of Legends and Losers a free 60-minute business review with an expert in your industry to help identify growth opportunities. So go to netsuite.com/legends set up your review. And then it's good to know things, and you will with NetSuite. All right. We would like to thank the amazing book from our friend and today's guest, our most frequent guest on Legends and Losers. I love her dearly, Dushka Zapata. Her new book coming out on Amazon.com, How to Build a Pillow Fort and Other Valuable Life Lessons. Speaking of books, the number one bestseller from Heather Clancy and Christopher Lockhead. Isn't it weird when people talk in the third person about themselves? Niche down. Go to Amazon.com. And while you're there picking up a copy of How to Build a Pillow Fort and Other Valuable Life Lessons, you can also pick up Niche Down. Spiro, the sales app for salespeople who like to make money. Check out Spiro.ai. Equity Directory, connecting startups and people who want to work with those startups for primarily equity. If you're in the startup ecosystem, you got to be on EquityDirectory.com. Now, We know because Google Analytics tells us it appears that we have a growing audience in Australia. If you're a marketing leader, you're a business leader, you're a CEO, and you want to do something legendary in marketing, check out rapidmedia.com.au. Legendary marketing outcomes in beautiful Australia. Now, are you a thought leader? Get your leading thoughts on some awesome podcasts with interviewvalet.com. They are my podcast booking agent. They specialize in podcast interview marketing, and they'll get your leading thoughts out there. Now, are you feeling a little whelmed? Overly so? Is it time for an assistant? Have you thought about maybe a virtual assistant? Well, check out bottleneck.online, the amazing business delivering virtual assistants to help you get more done more quickly and more awesomely. And a new podcast that I love from the amazing Bob Evans. He's a dear friend for many years. He's one of the smartest guys I know. I've been begging him for a long time to start a podcast, and he finally did it. Check out Cloud Wars Live, wherever you get legendary podcasts, and the incredible people at Doctors Without Borders. When you make a donation, they make a difference with some of the most at-risk people in some of the most terrifying, scary, tough places on planet Earth. Check out doctorswithoutborders.org. All right. I need to remind you that this oddcast is the sole property of the Legends and Losers and the Odd... Oddcast Network. Today's information is provided to you solely for informational purposes. Clearly, this oddcast is produced in a studio that contains nuts and a lot of severe lack of professionalism. However, Legends and Losers is never tested on GMOs. Remember that the left lane is the passing lane. Have class and let us pass. Listen to Linkin Park. Chris Cornell was right. Tom Waits said, fishing for a good time starts with throwing in your line. Always shower with a friend. Thank you, Dandy Candy. I love you, Mom and Dad. And hey, Colin, this oddcast really ties the room together, doesn't it? Today, our deepest apologies go out to Greg Clark, CEO of Symantec. Sorry, Greg, we just ran out of time for you. That's it, my friends. Thank you so much. It means the world to me that you invest part of your life with us here on Legends and Losers. And we'll look forward to seeing you again very soon.